fact is the incentives are completely different. Quebec has been paid to stay in Canada. We are paying to stay in Canada.
Welcome to the show that the fact checkers warned you about. The one that debunks the mainstream narrative and gives you high signal, actionable content that helps you navigate the clown world. It's Bomb Thrower TV with your host, Mark Jeftovic.
Mark Jeftovic here for another episode of Bomb Thrower TV. It's been a while because I looked and I haven't done one of these since last August of 2025. So a great way to kick off the new year, one quarter in, with none other than Dave Bradley. And I don't even know how to describe you in one, one simple blanket term. I'll let you describe yourself. So who are you? Where are you based? What are you up to?
Yeah, I'm broadly known as the strongest and best looking Bitcoin entrepreneur in Canada. I've been in the Bitcoin industry since 2010 and have gotten myself into a whole bunch of stuff in the space. I run a couple different companies and am involved in a few others. And I run a conference called the Bitcoin Rodeo out of Calgary, Alberta, here where I am. And you'll notice that I don't say any names after the word Alberta, because that's what I hope we're heading towards, is a time when I don't have to say Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Well, that's on my list of things to talk about, and we'll probably get there perhaps sooner than later. 2010, I mean, I got involved in Bitcoin in 2013, and I kind of thought I was late to the scene, but I don't often meet people who were on scene earlier than me. So how did you get there in 2010?
Yeah, I was looking up video cards for gaming, and I was like on a Reddit thread or something like that. And somebody was like, oh, if you buy this one, you can mine Bitcoin with it. And then it kind of hooked in my brain, and I did the thing that everybody does when they hear about Bitcoin, where they like, oh, that's interesting. And then you don't take it seriously for a little while. And then you come back like sometime later. And for me, it was like when I circled back some months later, it was like Bitcoin had just hit a dollar. And I was like, well, if these are worth more than a regular dollar, this could be a big deal. Mm-hmm. And little did I know.
Yeah. Little did any of us know. I mean, I'm not here to talk about my past, but part of my story was we started taking e-gold in like the early aughts, which was like a digital gold currency. I don't know if you're familiar with it. So for me, it was this instant pattern recognition. And where e-gold failed because it was too centralized, like it seemed like Bitcoin solved that problem, you know? So it was kind of an instant pattern recognition for me. And then just kind of, so what did you do? Did you mine it in the early days or?
Yeah, I was a miner. So it was a lot harder to find information about Bitcoin, obviously, back then. And there wasn't this wealth of information about hard money, really, right? And that wasn't really even in the discourse. I was looking at Bitcoin as just a way to make more dollars. And it worked out that way back then. Because, yeah, I was mining it in my basement. I was selling it on a website called Local Bitcoins. Mm. Just meeting up with people and buying more video cards and mining more Bitcoin. And then eventually 2013 rolled around and it was starting to get hot once again. And we opened a physical store here in Calgary called Bitcoin Brains, which is now my handle on everything. And it was, I think, the first like physical brick and mortar Bitcoin store in the world. It's the first one that I know of anyway.
Yeah. And so what was it that flipped your brain from Bitcoin as a way to load up on more dollars to like, no, Bitcoin is the thing that I want to trade dollars for?
Yeah, it's a couple things. One is you just get like really smacked in the face by your high time preference.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you make decisions, like everybody who's been in Bitcoin for a while has a story about like selling Bitcoin to buy something that, you know, like,
yeah, mine's embarrassing.
Yeah. And like, I'm not going to get into mine on the air, but I'll tell you sometime, but there's, you know what I mean? Like you buy something and then you're like, oh, I could have actually bought 10,000 of those if I would have just waited.
Yeah.
And it kind of starts to reshift your thinking on how Bitcoin functions as a savings tool. And that's, that's kind of like the ground up intellectual journey, I think, is you just start to see the results and then, you know, you make your conclusions based on the results. And then the other direction that I've experienced also is, you know, just the development of kind of like the Bitcoin intellectual sphere, right? So we had the first Bitcoin rodeo was here in Calgary in 2018. And we had Saifedean a few months after the Bitcoin Standard came out. And, you know, the Bitcoin Standard was a great history of money and also was really just sort of like crystallizing a lot of what, you know, the discussion had been around that time in the Bitcoin industry, in the Bitcoin sphere. And it was the first time that it was like really so concretely put into words that way. And that's why it's, you know, that's why it sold a million copies. So for me, like the sort of intellectual side of the journey happened at the same time as the practical, and the Bitcoin Standard and those other books, a lot of other books came out around that time, are a big part of that.
And the liberal tears cup, I gotta love it. So you've even gone radical, like from a normie point of view, to say like sell your house, buy Bitcoin. Is that something you would still even advise today?
Yeah, I mean, it's buying a house comes with some benefits. You know, you can knock down a wall or dig a hole or whatever you want. Nobody can tell you no. But at the end of the day, it's not really your house, right? You essentially have a lease from the government. As long as you're willing to keep paying them your property taxes, they will allow you, under their monopoly of violence, to continue to own your own property. And so, you know, there isn't, like, people have this sort of false sense of security of like you want to own something. You don't really own your house. You own the right to continue to have your house with someone else's permission. And then you look at it financially, and it's a catastrophic financial decision for the last 20 years. It has been, when you compare it to any other sort of tool that you could have been using for the store of value. And that's, you know, I'm of an age where my parents did really well on the house that they bought. And it, you know, we were taught, it's such a great financial decision to get into home ownership. And for many people for a long time, it was. And really all that they were doing was they were using the fact that houses were a lot harder to print than money. And so they were using that characteristic of houses to bring in an element of money into home ownership. And so they were actually using houses as money, which they're obviously a terrible form of money because they're not liquid at all. They're not divisible at all. And the utility of them warps the value of the monetary premium. And so, but that's what we've seen, is that real estate has gained this massive monetary premium because it's been one of the only places that a regular person could reliably store their wealth and not have it whittled away by the money printer. And now we're at a point where we have a better form of money. And we're also starting to see that a lot of the world is sort of starting to wake up to the melting ice cube of fiat currency and look elsewhere for a way to store their value. Obviously a lot of people have gone to gold, silver, those are booming, but the fact is that we now have the best form of money that the world has ever seen. And if you want to store your value over a long term, there's no reason to try to do that with the house, because, you know, it is a lot easier to make houses than it is to make Bitcoin.
I actually didn't have it in my head to debate this point this specifically today, but I just started thinking of the Karadza brothers, who I'm sure you know, like Tom and Nick. And so what do you think of their playbook? So they're, for the viewers who don't know them, Rockstar Real Estate, Your Life, Your Terms, their main thing is rental income through real estate. And they sort of special, like if you talk to them, they'll sort of drill down a lot of the times student housing, right? And they are big Bitcoin guys and they're still real estate guys. So their playbook now is, because the returns on rental real estate aren't great, like they're always just leveraging Nick explained it to me, or maybe it was Tom, we realized what the central banks were doing and realized that real estate was a way to do the same thing as the central banks, which is to sort of lever up and print value. But now they've modified it since So you buy a place, a student rental house, let's say, I'm numbers off the top of my head, 25% down payment. The rest is floated by the bank. The bank will often give you a line of credit against the house. And instead of taking a few hundred bucks a month off of the student rental place, you just buy Bitcoin with the line of credit and use the student rental income to pay the interest on the line of credit. What do you think of that?
I mean, it's an interesting gamble because you're kind of tapping into the fact that the fiat system is set up for so much leverage on real estate. And so, you're like you say, you're doing the same thing as the central banks. You're tapping into the Cantillon effect and really getting what is otherwise very, very cheap money for this real estate, right? The core play at the center of this is the idea that you buy the real estate and then you rent it out and it makes you a profit, right? And the big risk there is the same problem that makes real estate a bad form of money is that it is very illiquid. And we're seeing that in Toronto right now, where like the real estate's in basically in free fall. And if you've been making, like if you've been making 10% on your investment for the last 3 years on a house that you bought in 2023, like you're screwed, right? Like you've wiped out all your gains, you've lost more on your principal, and you still don't know how to get out of that asset. And so it's a bit of a risky play, that whole circle, but you're kind of betting on like, is this going to continue? Is the sort of like musical chairs kick the can down the road game of the current global fiat economy going to continue for a while longer? Because if it is, then the mortgage, you're going to continue to be able to lever up like that, and you're going to continue to be able to take that risk, I guess. And at the same time, like, if you did that and you have a bunch of Bitcoin that you bought in 2023, the same time as that house, then you're probably feeling a lot better.
It is kind of a nice barbell trade, right? Especially if you're underwater on the mortgage, but it's cash flowing enough to cover your mortgage payment and your line of credit on the Bitcoin, and you have a low time preference, like you don't need to get out of this anytime soon. It's actually not bad. It's a not bad way to stack sats, really. You've obviously, like most Bitcoins, you're probably familiar with Hugo Steins, the inflation king from Weimar Germany. But as you're talking about this, like the risks of that kind of a play, I found myself wondering, because I don't know this, what's your position on strategy, MicroStrategy?
It's good that companies are buying Bitcoin. It makes the companies better. I think we're probably going to see another wave of Bitcoin treasury companies that is more, how can Bitcoin support the company? How can it change the capital stack, the borrowing, the lending, anything that, you're doing in that realm? Bitcoin can be a big part of it because it's a great savings tool, but it's also the best form of collateral. So it can be very useful in some scenarios, but strategy where you just basically like eclipse the actual $2 billion data intelligence company and turn it into like a Bitcoin ETF that for some reason offers a bunch of financial services, like, and there was no mystery that that premium was going to evaporate, right? There was no reason for someone to pay more at all, let alone like 2.5 times more for exposure to Bitcoin through MicroStrategy than you could just get buying it yourself. And so, good for them, I guess, for leveraging the sort of hype and using the same kind of technique. Like it's kind of the same thing as the mortgage, right? Like
Yeah, it's the same deal. It's you're leveraging, you're borrowing fiat, which is a decaying currency, to buy Bitcoin, which is increasing in fiat terms.
And in this term, your house is the collateral, and in the MicroStrategy example, they use the public vehicle to turn the Bitcoin into the collateral. And so it's pretty similar, but it has the same risks, right? And to your point, you were saying about cash flow, like if you can wait and you have the cash flow, then you're great. But part of the thing that we're likely to see, you see how house prices plummeting in Ontario, that's going to have a downward pressure on rent, because mm-hmm. more people are going to be able to afford homes. You know, they'll move out of rentals, and generally the monetary premium on housing is evaporating. And so the likelihood that your cash flow on your rental properties goes down significantly as we see the sort of air let out of the bubble, which, you know, that's what we're seeing right now. It's a kind of a gradual rather than a pop, but it is definitely deflating.
Yeah, it's kind of, a lot of things are deflating right now. Like even Bitcoin's off the highs, gold and silver, very volatile. The stocks, we kind of, I mean, they're still near highs, but feeling a little weak, little rolling over. I think a lot of that is, you know, uncertainty around what's going on politically in the world. I mean, we can get to that in a minute as well. What I was going to mention about MicroStrategy, I was waiting for years. I hold MicroStrategy. They're in the Bitcoin Capitalist portfolio. I'm like, okay, they're going to turn this data analytics company into something in the Bitcoin economy. And they've never really done that. Like, I haven't seen it happen. I don't know if it's going to happen.
Yeah. I don't know if there's a, like, I don't know if they want to, right? There's kind of this, this thing that gets more complicated as your company gets, you know, as you, like, if we were evaluating MicroStrategy's business units, they would not be a, like, you know, 10 figure, 11 figure company.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. if the data analytics business, because data analytics is a hot sector, right? If it was growing, like in terms of whatever, you know, Snowflake, Datadog, one of the big ones, then it's like, okay, we get it. And there, I think you touched on that earlier, where a Bitcoin balance sheet, a Bitcoin treasury can sort of not necessarily supercharge a company, but like really give it a solid foundation. Like I always say, EasyDNS, my main business, was the original Bitcoin treasury company, because we started taking it in 2013 and we just never sold it. And then now I think Bitcoin treasury companies as a sort of category are a little past their use by date, because again, we have ETFs, right? There's no point. What you need to do is figure out how you're going to use that Bitcoin to further the aims of your company. I mean, we've got LQWD here in Canada, Liquid. They're an actual operating Lightning company. They like operate the only global Lightning network in the world. And you see them actually deploying things and developing things that are based on the Bitcoin economy. I call it the Bitcoin Holdco concept, which nobody's really doing except maybe us, which is where you can collateralize some of your Bitcoin, a little bit of your Bitcoin, and you can like do an acquisition with it. And then you can use the cash flow from the acquisition to pay off your Bitcoin. And MicroStrategy, I did some back of the napkin math. I mean, it would not be a trivial undertaking, but MicroStrategy could take a very small portion of that huge hoard hodl. They could collateralize it 2-for-1, right? And they could buy, you know, bit farms, or, you know, a much bigger deal would be Marathon, which is like, I think, an 11 billion, 12 billion enterprise value now. But that would like put 900 Bitcoin a month into the treasury just on its own. But so here's the question. Now that Bitcoin has mainstreamed, right? We have ETFs, we have regulatory clarity, we have supposedly a Bitcoin president in the US, which I don't really buy. We've had a, you know, arguably, it was safe to run Bitcoin companies in Canada, aside from like being debanked half the time by like Royal Bank and others, but like you wouldn't go to jail for it. Now that we're here, we've arrived, so to speak. What do you like? I see a lot of disgruntlement among the Bitcoin community. Like, yeah, it wasn't supposed to be this. Now we're just shilling for suits. But what's your take on that?
You know, the saying is always Bitcoin is for enemies. So, like, we can't stop the suits from using Bitcoin. We can decide whether we sell them our Bitcoin, and they can't stop us from using Bitcoin. So it's we the sort of like anarchist basement nerds that got into Bitcoin earlier. We have the lead. So we're all still early. Anybody who's getting into Bitcoin now is still very early. And if you're talking about like a large scale consumer adoption, right? Like the majority of people still do not own Bitcoin, have never owned Bitcoin. And so there's a lot of market left to capture there.
That's a good point. I think people look at the price tag of the denominator of like the denomination and they kind of go, oh, I completely missed the boat. And what I tell people is don't look at the price tag, look at the market cap, right? So if Bitcoin is a one, what is it? Whatever it is today, 1.4 trillion, 1.5 trillion. And what's gold now? Like 25 trillion or 20 trillion? So you look at those comparisons, you look at like Apple, you look at Amazon, it's significant, but it's not absolutely huge. And I see, I think in the future, Bitcoin is just headed towards like 10 trillion, 15 trillion, 30 trillion over the next decade, decade and a half, because, there's no other alternative, really.
Yeah, just in the short term, like what you're describing with gold is that monetary premium. It's the same thing that is on real estate, right? And markets are never efficient because it takes a lot of time for information to move around markets. But what we're experiencing right now is that this particular information about money is moving around the market, and that is causing Bitcoin to soak up more of that monetary premium because a rational actor who understands money and understands Bitcoin will choose Bitcoin as their long-term savings tool. And so that 30 trillion, whatever that may be, from gold, the market cap of silver, there is some need for gold and silver. So there is a reason for them to maintain a market price for their industrial uses. But the vast majority of the price of both of them is that monetary premium. And Bitcoin is going to eat up that monetary premium, and that's the first step. I think we're headed into a decade or like you say, maybe a decade and a half of global currency wars that we're already seeing start. I would expect in the next 5 years we're going to be down to about six or seven currencies in the world, including Bitcoin, and the sort of big regional ones will have gobbled up everything. But they're all going to be fighting for that monetary premium, and it's kind of just math at the end of the day. Like they'll fall one by one, and the weaker currencies like the Bolivar or the Argentinian peso or whatever are going to fall first because they've been printing much more aggressively. But at the end of the day, our Canadian dollar is not much better. We've been printing very aggressively also.
I was going to
And
ask you, is the loonie going to make it or is the loonie not going to make it?
no, the loonie's not going to make it. It's
No.
there's no real reason for it to exist. There's no use case for it in international markets. There's no way to get anyone outside of Canada to use it. And there's like I said, there's been a massive amount of printing. We've printed more than any other developed nation, and we're lucky that things are not worse given how much they've printed of the Canadian dollar. But I see a path where the very high likelihood is that Alberta will not be part of Canada in the very near future. And I'm fairly certain that will lead to Quebec following suit. And from there, it's like what's holding the country together at that point. So
Well, we were going to get there, so we're here now. I was going to segue because I think being Canadian, even nominally for now, if not, if you've left you quit the program psychologically, being Canadian sort of gives you a unique sort of Bitcoin-centric view on the world if you're aware of what's going on because of the money printing has been quite bad here in Canada. And then of course the Emergency Act, the emergency powers, seizing of the bank accounts, martial law happened right here in Canada to us, G7 nation, can never take that away. That left an indelible scar on me, probably you, a lot of people we know. And you just set the table for some of that. You think it's just a matter of time before Alberta's out the door. Did you hear like Francis from Bull Bitcoin was on with Joey from Canadian Bitcoiners about a week and a half ago, and he actually said it's more likely for Alberta to go than for Quebec to go, and he kind of laid out all the reasons why. But I think you're right that it is a matter of time and then Alberta's gone, because I often say things don't change unless the incentives change. And right now the incentives are completely aligned against Alberta for staying in Canada.
Yeah, it's an absurd deal, and it's, you know, we get paid, or we get compared to the Quebec referendum all the time, and the fact is the incentives are completely different. Like, Quebec has been paid to stay in Canada, and
Right.
we are paying to stay in Canada. So
That's a huge
the
difference.
yeah, it's a massive difference, and there's enough pressure on people now. Like, the cost of living has gone through the roof. Food is through the roof, housing is through the roof, and wages have stagnated. Obviously, the economy's shit. We're a little bit better off in Alberta in that we have higher average incomes, and we still have the oil industry here, but it's nothing compared to what it was when we had an actually functioning capitalist economy and people could develop large scale oil projects in Alberta. So, we're living in a very stifled, centrally planned economy right now. And we're having to pay to do that. And it makes, frankly, no sense, right? And I did the math. This is a ChatGPT research project. So it's, you got to take it with a grain of salt. But I think it was fairly sound methodology here, where I basically tracked every government service that the federal government provides to Albertans. And then I went back and said, okay, if the provincial government was going to have to take over all of those services and provide them to Albertans at the same cost for the same services, which is quite a low bar, I would say, because
Yeah.
the government is not exactly known for providing quality of anything to anyone ever. But if we were to just hit that very low bar, and the entire savings that we get from our federal income tax and the transfer payments that go out through our federal income tax, if we were to take that entire savings and just put it into a straight up tax break, the average Albertan would save $17,000 to $25,000 a year. Like, the incentives are very clear. Who's not going to vote for themselves to get $17,000? And it's just a matter of people understanding the scope of the larceny that we've been through. And I think the average Albertan is starting to wake up to that. And a big part of that is just because the scale of the theft has gotten so extreme that it's putting a lot of pressure on people's lifestyles, and you start to send people to the food bank, and that's when things start to change.
Well, let's look at that a bit. So, when was the election? It was April 2025, right? So, like, it's close to a year ago. I have never been as wrong about the mind of the public and as disappointed in the Canadian public as I have been since the last federal election. I am so disenfranchised, I will probably never vote again. Like, I'm just like fucking done. But we were headed for, and it's not necessarily that I endorse the Canadian Conservative Party, although I'm probably considered a conservative. But after 10 years of incumbent mismanagement, right? Like, just the entire country becoming a laughing stock internationally, right? Declaring martial law on its own citizens, running the economy into the ground, taking us from being one of the most prosperous nations in the world to a third world banana republic, on track for an absolute blowout of the incumbent government, right? I watched, brief aside, my wife is Barbadian. When their last federal election happened, like before Mia Motley got in now, The old incumbent government was blown out so badly, they won 0 seats. And because of the constitution and the parliament there, one of their own party had to cross the floor in order to form an opposition party because the incumbents had been just destroyed, like just utterly annihilated. And that's what we were headed for in Canada. And then all of a sudden, Donald Trump, 51st state, elbows up, boom, the whole thing changes. Okay. Now we have a quasi-majority government re-upped. Alberta actually went almost all conservative. The Albertans didn't buy this for 1 second. Let's start there.
Yeah, we we've got our foot in the door of liberty, I would say. And it if you talk to the average Albertan, there are still too many people who are fooled. And you mentioned COVID. Every time the government does something catastrophically stupid, it wakes up some more people, right? You kill a bunch of ostriches, wakes up a bunch more people. And I was kind of in the same spot. I think Donald Trump very deliberately picked Carney to win.
Yeah, he did.
That 51st state stuff was like just came out of nowhere at exactly the right time to give Carney the boost. And I think you have to look at it all in the sort of context of, the big battle that Trump is in with Europe at this point. And he wanted Canada very clearly as an enemy in that game. Right, because we were one of the sort of satellite terrorist entities set up by this city of London to flood the United States with drugs and illegals and really try to just bring them out of what has been their golden age. And this group of people, the bankers of Europe, have systematically looted the world for hundreds of years. And we're now only getting to a point where an American president is finally standing up to them, and we've just been made a pawn in that whole game. And he wanted Carney because it's an easy fight to pick and it's an easy fight to win, right? Every time there's like an international like debate or argument between Canada and the United States in the last year, it's just a very quick and embarrassing defeat for Canada. Like, oh shit, we sorry, like we're gonna have to take back what we said last week, and we're not actually gonna do the tariffs that we said that we would do on you if you take away some of the tariffs that you did in return, and we end up in an objectively worse situation every single time. There couldn't be a politically easier person to beat than Mark Carney, because Carney doesn't really care. Like he knows Canada is over. He's not a Canadian. He's from Europe as well. He worked for the Bank of England, right? He's a pawn of that same European banker class, and he is currently in the process of looting Canada for that European banker class, and it's incredibly transparent.
Now, is that, do you think that is the reason? Like, I don't, no one really disagrees that, Trump, however you think about him, tipped the scales in Carney's favor. The question is why, right? You laid out your reasons why. I used to go on Steve Bannon's show on a fairly regular basis, and I was kind of like carping at him one night. I'm like, dude, we fucking had this in the bag until your guy opened his mouth. And he basically, more or less, either he was joking or whatever, but he said, 4 more years of left-wing Marxism in Canada, and we get Alberta with all that oil and gas. What's not to love? And that to me feels like probably the main motivator to tip the scales. It's sort of like, whatever, what do you call it? Destabilization operation, right? Like,
Yeah.
let's Alberta's on the verge of getting out. Let's make sure they're out. If Alberta separates, when Alberta separates, do you see that as a sustainable separation? Do you see Alberta eventually becoming the 51st state? Does it matter?
Yeah. So I think you're right in that sense. Like it's an accelerationist view, basically, right? Of like, let's just burn this shit down. There's there's very little appetite to be a 51st state here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know anybody who wants to be the 51st state. And I don't know that it necessarily matters that much from the perspective of the Americans, whether we become the 51st state, because what they really want is access to our oil and access to our markets, right? We want free trade with the United States. And I imagine that an independent Alberta will have a very favored trade deal with the United States that hopefully comes with a very large pipeline.
Have any trouble getting those approved.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. right now we're also paying a premium. This is kind of the situation that we're in as Albertans, is we're paying premiums everywhere we look to parasites attached to us. We're paying a premium to essentially Warren Buffett because we don't have enough pipeline capacity, and so a lot of oil has to go on a train.
Yeah.
And that works out to about $18 a barrel to transport on a train. And so it's a massive drain. You know, that's another, if we had that pipeline, it's more like $3 to $5 a barrel to move oil through the pipeline. And it's just more value being siphoned out of our country. And so I see and hope for a time when Alberta is just a fully independent nation and we have good trade relations with our neighbors, the Americans, and whatever is left of Canada. You know, we're obviously going to have our good relations with our neighbors in the West here, but our neighbors out East, I think you guys need some pain out there.
We got pain.
Yeah. I think that,
man, I don't want any harsh pain, but yeah, we're getting it.
I think the harsh realities of collectivism need to settle into the homes of people in Toronto and Montreal a little bit more before, they'll take the blinders off. Montreal, I guess, is starting.
Don't you mean the warmth of collectivism? Isn't collectivism warm?
Yeah, I mean, you can huddle together to stay warm when you're in the bread lines. That's very the collectivist warmth.
So what would you... Okay, so I'm in Ontario, kind of stuck here. Not stuck here, but, you know, my kid's here. My wife's family is here. Like, I am kind of stuck. Like, you know, I'm working on my second passport and all that stuff. But like, so what's your advice to sort of non-collectivist Ontarians?
Oh, I mean, the best advice is to leave. we are going to get an amazing migration in the next little while. I know a bunch of Bitcoiners have already moved to Alberta. Some have brought Bitcoin businesses here to Alberta as well. And I saw a hilarious article from the Globe and Mail that 40% of Albertans might leave if we become independent. And that's a hilariously stupid number, but like, sure, go ahead, right? And I think we will get a migration in both directions where the blue-haired crazies and their old white ladies that are so hysterical about, you know, they're hysterical about everything, frankly, but they're hysterical about anything that touches the right-wing sphere. Those people will hopefully be moving down to your neighborhood. And
so it's going to get even worse here.
Yeah, it is. It is. And there's going to be an incentive for all of the smartest and most useful people in Canada to move to Alberta. We're going to have a tremendous number of business owners, just all the useful people will want to move there, and we'll be in a position, I believe, where, you know, like you said, you're working on your second passport. There's all these other places that you can go in the world that are kind of like freedom outposts. You know, you can go to Panama or Costa Rica or Paraguay or wherever. And you have, in most of those places, a bunch more freedom than you do here. But they all come with a trade-off because none of those places are in the first world.
Yeah.
And we could be the first freedom jurisdiction in the developed world in modern times. And that would provide us a huge, huge advantage in going into what I believe is basically the playing out of the thesis from the book, The Sovereign Individual, where nation states are going to fracture into much smaller entities that become much more like service providers to their citizens, who become much more like customers. And those nation states will have to compete for the most valuable citizens. And we're just sort of at the tip of the iceberg of that. And I think Alberta is really well positioned to get a big influx of that kind of, you know, of that those kind of people. And there may come a point, like it would be a tough sell for you probably right now because it's all speculation. But once we've got there, and you could look at your family and say, hey, we're going to save X amount of money if we move to Alberta. You know, your wife's family might be willing to move if there's a big ticket on that says they're going to save a lot more money. And so, we'll see what the world brings. But like, if you got to stay there, like I would just, you know, keep my head down. You don't want to attract the attention of the woke mob. You don't want those people's attention. You don't have to rely on the state for your safety against radical leftists, because that won't work out very well. So
yeah, you're really on your own here. It's actually like I got that side project that Joey and I and a couple other people are spinning up called ready.ca, and that's the slogan, like, we're on our own, right? We can't count on the police, we can't count on the government, we can't count on really public infrastructure institutions, and that's where we're headed. What do you think would happen to Alberta? I think it's naive, I do, to say like the legal tender in Alberta will be Bitcoin. I just don't see it happening. I can see them, they'll probably make some really accommodative tax rules and stuff around it, like no capital gains on Bitcoin sales and yada yada. But what do you think happens to the legal tender in Alberta? Would they just sort of dollarize, like US dollarize, or what do you think?
Yeah, so there's a bunch of possibilities. We do have a Bitcoiner as a premier.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
Daniel Smith is a Bitcoiner, so that's a positive. There have been talks about setting up a Bitcoin reserve for the province, and there's a really strong Bitcoin community and industry here in Alberta. So if anywhere's going to do it, we have a chance. I suspect there'll probably be some negotiations on separation, and we're probably going to we're going to be going one of two paths. We're either going to negotiate our way out of Confederation with Canada, which is plan A. It has to be plan A. You know, we live in a high trust society that based on the rule of law, and we have a constitution that we would like to follow on the way out. And that constitution requires an intellectually honest response from the government of Canada, which I'm quite certain we will not get. So if we vote to separate, they're not going to just let us separate. They're going to try and sue us. They're going to try and stop us. They're going to try and do anything that they can through legal or illegal means to keep us from leaving the country. And if that becomes the case, at a certain point, the rubber hits the road and we just say, we don't care what the Supreme Court of Canada says. We don't care what the government of Canada says. We are unilaterally declaring our independence. And at that point, you know, the discussion becomes a lot more like, what other kind of treaties are we going to strike? And so as long as we've got Trump in power, especially, we're really well positioned for Alberta to sort of have the United States as a backup to that plan A. And if we can't come to a fruitful negotiation on the way out of Canada, which will probably involve us paying our way out, then the plan B is we go to the Americans. And one of the things that we would have to offer the Americans in a very significant sense in any kind of trade deal, anything that came with any kind of military protection, would be that we would take on the US dollar. Mm-hmm. Because any country that takes on the US dollar is essentially allowing the United States to outsource their inflation to that country. And so as Albertans, if we took on the Canadian dollar, Canada would be able to print money and dilute our savings. And if we took on the American dollar, the Americans would be able to print money and dilute our savings. So neither is a good spot, but I kind of suspect we end up in one of those. And my guess would be the United States dollar, which would also, it would grease the wheels of trade. It would make things a lot simpler to be on the US dollar here. But the third option that I've heard discussed a little bit, there's a group called the Alberta Prosperity Project here that's kind of running the campaign for independence. And they had put out a document suggesting that Alberta could have its own currency. Hmm. And that would be backed by some mix of gold, silver, oil, and Bitcoin, which is kind of an interesting idea. It really is just like another layer of fiat, but it's a coin like that, or a currency like that, would just be objectively better than a currency backed by nothing. And it would be the toe in the door of Bitcoin, because it's, you know, you start using Bitcoin as a monetary reserve asset, and pretty soon you're like, why don't we just use it as the money itself? So we'll see.
You mentioned, you know, as long as Trump is in. So that's a tight timeline. I mean, the guy's got a little over 2 years left. He could be a lame duck after November. We have no idea what's going to happen there. I don't, in my mind, I wasn't thinking it could happen that quickly, but we live in a world where things are accelerating. What are your thoughts around timelines? And what happens in a post-Trump world? I think about it a lot.
So we're timelines. We're going to have the vote in October. I think we're going to win the vote on the first try. I think we're going to win it handily on the first try. I think there's a lot of people around the country that really underestimate how strong the sentiment is and how sick the normies of Alberta are of being looted. When you got the normies, you know, they move as a crowd, right? Mm-hmm. And so the Overton window is shifting, and more people are sick of this, and more people are ready to get out. And so I think we will get out, starting with that October referendum, which then
is that referendum actually on separation, or is it?
So there's going to be a three-part referendum. The separation referendum right now is not official, because we're going through, there's a petition signing.
Okay.
Where they have to gather 176,000 signatures in a certain time frame to get it on that ballot. But it's going to, I don't think there's any chance that we don't get the 176,000 signatures. I think it's like, we may get a much, much bigger number than that. I think they're trying to get a much, much bigger number. And so if we get to that number, there'll be three questions on the, on that referendum. And it'll be one about independence, one about should we control our immigration, and one about should we renegotiate transfer payments? And, you know, obviously, the answer is yes. We've already voted in a referendum to renegotiate transfer payments, and Ottawa has just been like, nah,
we're not going to. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a little bit of a hedge there, in that Daniel Smith is putting those other things on there in just in case we lose.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we end up with the 40-45% vote to leave and an 80-90% vote to control our own immigration, then that's a pretty strong mandate for her. So I think that's where those questions come in. But yeah, back to your previous question, like if we do vote to succeed, then, you know, we then have this sort of negotiation pattern after the vote, where Ottawa is going to try and honey dick us every which way. They're going to say, we'll give you pipelines, we'll give you this, and we'll give you that. And it's all going to be a lie. And we're going to have to cut through whatever lies they're trying to tell us on the way out. And, you know, I hope there's a low tolerance for their bullshit on that stuff, because their move will be to stretch it out and hope that Trump loses power, because that would change the scenario very drastically if we went back to a Democratic controlled president who, you know, for a long time, the Democrats have themselves been agents of that same banker class in the city of London. So the people who own Canada right now, if they get control of the United States again, we will have a much harder time getting out from under it. And we'll probably have to wait for another Republican president. But I kind of don't think that that's where the divide in American politics is going to be. I think the Democratic Party might be pretty much done. I think the divide is going to be more between like the MAGA Trump supporters and the neocons.
That's almost how it's looking now, isn't it? It's weird, because Trump is almost leaning neocon these days, and it's kind of it's hard to read, you know? And so let's say, yeah, I don't want to navel gaze U.S. politics too much, because it's kind of out of my control and I just spend too much time thinking about it. But going back to our politics and Alberta politics, if the polling leading up to October looks like dire for Ottawa, right, and the Laurentian elites, they're not going to wait to try and screw you after the referendum, they're going to do another like elbows up psyop, right? Of something in Alberta. I don't know what it is. It'll be like mega cringe. It's going to work on a lot of people. It didn't last year, but I mean, they'll pick something acutely sensitive to Albertans and run that kind of idiocy.
So they're trying, but I think there's this phenomenon going on where the left, and especially the politicians on the left, are increasingly losing touch with reality. And the kind of things that they find they should be supporting are so broadly unpopular. You know, the like trans school stuff, the like let's kill the ostriches, like who wanted those ostriches killed? Like they find it impossible to read the room at this point. And like the thing that got Carney in was not a stroke of genius by the liberal Laurentian elite and their strategist. It was Trump,
Yes, that is true.
right? They didn't like they had no plan, right? Like their plan was let's change to this other guy. And like there was no real inflection point other than Trump getting involved. And like the whole elbows up thing quickly became such a laughing stock. I don't think that converted any voters. So I think I'm not that worried about the globalist information campaigns anymore because they're so like they're just laughably ridiculous. And if anything, I feel like every time they do something like that, they just wake up more people. And they are going to have a harder time staying away from things like killing the ostriches than, you know, whatever their propaganda attempts may be, like their own evil and stupidity will outshine those without a doubt.
I hope you're right. This is probably a good place to wind it up. Why don't you talk about Bitcoin Rodeo, the agenda? I'm going to be out there. I'm happy to come out for the first time. I'm actually bringing Angela. We're going to, when we've talked about leaving, Alberta is the one place, like US is a non-starter. She's like, I'm not moving to Florida. I'm not moving to Texas. I could see myself living in Alberta, depending on how bad it gets here, so we're gonna come out early and we're gonna look at some, scope out the foothills of the Rockies and see what if we like it out that way, and then come by the Bitcoin Rodeo. What can we expect?
Yeah, so the Bitcoin Rodeo, like I said earlier, is here in Calgary, Alberta. It's June 25th and 26th this year. 2 day conference. It's a very non-technical conference. It's designed to be useful for Bitcoin psychos and also to be approachable for people who are just wondering what's going on. And we have about 600 oil companies headquartered within 10 blocks of where we hold the conference. So we've got a pretty big focus on oil and gas and how that plays into Bitcoin mining this year. And yeah, I mean we're a really freedom focused conference. So we're going to be talking about all the ways that Bitcoin can help make us more free and how it changes our lives in ways that make us more free. And yeah, the sort of headliner that we've got this year is the roast of Tatum Turnup. Any Bitcoiners will probably know Tatum. And we did the roast of BTC Sessions a couple of years ago, and we're bringing back the roast. It's gonna be a good time. So we look forward to seeing you here. Are you going out to Banff?
Yeah, I will. I
The
think,
foothills?
yeah, I've got to, I don't think Angela's ever been out that way, so I got to show her Banff and around that area, and then we'll come by Calgary.
Yeah, definitely. It's a big part of the selling feature of the region is that you're an hour from incredible mountains. So take her out there and check out the Kenrick Hotel, which they take Bitcoin and they give you 20% off if you pay in Bitcoin. So
Oh, I didn't know that. Nice.
yeah.
I'll check it out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave. And then where else? Bitcoinbrains.com, of course. And
Bitcoin Brains on Twitter, although I'm not that active anymore, but I occasionally pop my head up to argue with strangers.
that's what X is for. All right, man. Nice seeing you again. We'll see you
Yeah,
soon.
good talking to you.
All right, take it easy.
Bye.